Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over the green world?
Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
all right, all right, all right. We are at the back for another hour here at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I'm Harvey Wasserman. I got a great show today on the Occupy Movement with Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers. We are talking about nuclear power and so many other things. Perhaps a new article by Danny Schechter that was posted at Huffington Post. Kevin and Margaret, are you with us? We're really glad to have you. I saw you speak, both of you, on a panel at the Ralph Nader Controlling the Corporations Conference a bit ago. And lots of controversy and lots of great stuff with the Occupy movement. People all over the world have been inspired and energized and given hope by the Occupy movement. It's been a tremendous boost, jump forward. It really, one of the great things I think about the Occupy movement is it transcended that corporate-sponsored Tea Party nonsense. You know, the media was filled with all these alleged green, Tea Party activists, so-called grassroots, tons of corporate money. Can you give us an accounting? How many millions of dollars have you gotten from Monsanto and General Motors?
We've been doing this on a grassroots budget. No big corporate donors at all. So
Now, you're getting money from ALEC, I heard, and you know, the Air Force, I think, has bought a few ads on your website. Can you tell us, Farby? I did speak to the Occupy gathering in Boston. It was really, really a great experience. They didn't throw anything at me, and we talked for almost 2 hours. It was really, really fun. A beautiful, beautiful gathering there, and I was also in Zuccotti Park. But tell us, either one and both of you, actually, give us a thumbnail of what you think the Occupy movement really is about and what it stands for.
Go ahead, Margaret. You can go with that.
Sure, thanks. Well, you know, when we started organizing the occupation of Freedom Plaza back in April of 2011, we actually had no money. It just felt like the time was right to start trying to build an independent, nonviolent, broad-based social movement. It was a number of activists that came together because we all realized that working on single issues, we were facing the same obstacles, the corporate control of the political process and of much of the media. Fortunately, we have new independent media that's replacing that. But we, you know, when we talked to other groups, everybody was kind of saying the same thing, that we needed to join together in our efforts, and we were very inspired by what was happening around the world and by what was happening in Madison.
What was happening in Madison?
Well, we were out there in March when they were occupying the Capitol. There had been some teaching assistants union that was organizing a rally. They knew that budget cuts were going to be coming under the new governor, Scott Walker. What they didn't realize...
Who's now being recalled, hopefully.
Yeah, yeah. They didn't realize at the time that, you know, he was going to release his budget just before that, and it was going to inspire, you know, so much action when people saw the cuts that were being made. And so what was being planned as a rally that they thought would have a few hundred turned into a march with thousands and then an occupation of the Capitol that just really took off with people from all across the state getting involved, farmers driving their tractors in, people outside protesting every day. It was a lot of excitement and energy there.
Kevin?
I'd say the Occupy, you know, stands for really ending corporate rule and shifting power to people. If you want to put it in Occupy terms, it's shifting power from the 1% to the 99%, not just in government, but also in the economy. And I think the economy may be the most important part because I think governance will follow that. it seems to be often the character of government to follow the money. And so I think that's really got to focus on developing a more democratized economy, building things like workaround co-ops, moving toward a sustainable, clean energy economy, and really breaking energy down to everybody's homes, workplaces, parking garages. I mean, just really breaking down energy production from a 1% type of concentrated production system to a dispersed one. And I think that's kind of part of the message. I think what was great about Occupy was it showed people they were not alone. People came out all over the country willing to sleep in public parks and state their opposition to Wall Street domination. And I think that was just a powerful moment for everyone to see that. Now we have to figure out how to go to the next level and take Occupy on and keep it going, because this is not a one Occupy solves the problem situation. This is a multi-year, perhaps multi-decade, 10 to 20-year kind of effort to to break up the corporate power that's been coming really for decades. It's been building for decades. And so we have to break that chokehold, and that's not an easy task. And so we have to figure out how to go to the next steps. We always saw Occupy Freedom Plaza as a tactic, kind of like a freedom ride was a tactic in the civil rights movement. The Occupy of Freedom Plaza is a tactic in ending the corporatist and militarist government that we have.
Well, what do you think your impact has been?
I think we've had a very good impact. I think what we found out was that occupying public space also helped you occupy the part of the political dialogue. It was much harder for people to ignore you. And I think we had an impact not just on public debate. You can see it in polling, how that changed. You can see it in the rhetoric of politicians from both parties. But more, you can see it even in some policy. For example, when we started Occupy, there was this thing called the Super Committee that was supposed to solve the deficit problem. And they wanted to say...
Tell us about the Super Committee.
It was a committee appointed to kind of get around the legislative process, 12 people, 6 Republicans, 6 Democrats, 6 from the Senate, 6 from the House. And their job was
in the Congress. This is a federal undertaking.
And they were trying to cut $1.2 trillion over 10 years out of the federal budget. And they were on a path from all the news reports. They mainly met in secret, so we don't really know what they were doing. But there were news reports, and Obama was talking publicly about, cutting Social Security. He'd be the first Democrat president to do that. And there were Democrats, Republicans negotiating how to cut Social Security, how to cut Medicare, when those even weren't even the deficit problems. I mean, because those are funded by a line item tax from your payroll tax, and they are funded fine from those. With slight tinkering, Medicare and Social Security would be not an issue. The real issue is, of course, we're not taxing the 1%, and we have incredible spending on weapons and war, and the final thing, of course, is the collapsed economy. Those are the three reasons why we have a deficit, and the deficit committee wasn't even looking at those. They were looking to try to cut social programs and weaken the middle class rather than build a new economy we need to get out of the deficit and get people back to work. So we while this is going on, Occupy started to protest it. We had people protesting outside the Senate Hart building where they were met, outside in the hallway, and even inside the committee room. One of the people inside the committee room was Leah Bolger, who's the president of Veterans for Peace, and she bravely walked right to the front of the hearing room and right in front of the senators and members of Congress and said to them that they were lying to the American public. The real problem of the deficit was the 1% not being taxed and the overspending on weapons and war. And if we dealt with those two issues, we would have more than enough money to solve the deficit problem. And, we held on Freedom Plaza, we held our own occupied super committee hearing, kind of mocking the congressional super committee, and we said we were the liberated committee, and they were the ones occupied by corporate power, so they were very limited what they could do. We put forward our own plan, which attained that $1.2 trillion in savings in 2 years, because we faced up to the military and the 1%. And that, all we did was looked at history and looked at experience and applied evidence-based solutions to the real problems we face. We didn't limit ourselves to the political reality of inside the Beltway. We looked at what are the real problems and what are real evidence-based solutions. And these problems are all solvable. And it just showed the disconnect between people and government. But because of that pressure, the super committee did not even propose cutting Social Security, Medicare. They fell apart, realizing if they had gone that route, there would have been an explosion in the Occupy movement, and the protests and the rebellion would have grown significantly. So I think we successfully saved Social Security and Medicare for now. Of course, that work continues. That's just one example of a handful I could give you of how we've affected policy. And in addition to policy, Occupy activists and Occupy the Homes have saved more than 100 people from eviction through, you know, blocking foreclosures and evictions. So that's another area of great success.
Margaret?
Yeah, I think you bring up an important point, because there's a lot of talk about, you know, Occupy, they don't have any clear demands. And when we were planning the occupation, we looked at how do nonviolent movements actually shift power. And you know, the data says that you need to build a certain amount of power before you can actually start demanding things. So we didn't, you know, nobody in Occupy has specific demands. But despite that, we have had a tremendous effect, because now those who, you know, were in corporations are concerned. They know that people are onto their game, that they're watching them. Those in the government as well know that people are watching them much more closely and are willing to get out in the streets if they see things going on that are not right. And so we kind of have people on their guard. We know this through the National Defense Authorization Act, which contains provisions allowing the use of U.S. troops on our soil, allowing U.S. citizens to be detained, and that this is probably a response to the power of the Occupy movement. And we're still a very young movement. So right now the real focus is on building and growing that movement, educating people about what's going on and how we can shift power.
So what are the long-term plans?
Well, the long-term plans are to build on what Mark talked about. You know, we studied how nonviolent movements work. We found a few things. First off, we found that nonviolence works better than violence. There's a long history now of about 100 years of nonviolence as a political tactic, and in the last 100 years, there's strong evidence that nonviolence is much more effective than violence by significant differences. There's a book out called Why Civil Resistance Works that explains that. The other thing that that book shows is that of the nonviolent movements that win and the ones that fail, the difference is the ones that fail are fringe movements, the ones that win are mainstream mass movements. And so we have to build mass. We have to get bigger. And we are going to get bigger by showing the people who are involved in the power structure that, in fact, they'll be better off in the world we're trying to create. We talk to media people, for example, who work for, you know, Washington Post and Roll Call and, you know, the local TV news channels. And whenever we talk to them, we say to them, you'd be so much better off if the writers and the editors and the producers owned the newspaper or TV station rather than this family or this corporate interest or this conglomerate, whatever it is. And they all agree with us. They all see that under their current system, they're being mistreated. The same with police, the same with the military. I mean, on all these areas that are the power structure, they would be better off in a new world. And when you start to recognize, they start to recognize that, you pull them to our side. The way you win in a nonviolent movement is to weaken the pillars that hold the power structure in place. Those pillars include things like the military, the police, business interests, labor, youth, non-government offices, organizations, civil servants, and media. Those there's nine pillars essentially that hold the power structure in place. And our goal is to weaken those pillars and pull people from those pillars to our side. We want youth on our side. We want labor on our side. We want business on our side. We want small businesses to recognize that concentrated wealth is undermining their chance for growth. You know, so we want to keep pulling people to our side and building our movement, building our mass, while weakening the structure that holds the current powers in place. That's the long-term strategy.
Cool. Well, we're talking with Kevin Zeis and Margaret Flowers of the Occupy Movement. This is the Solartopia Green Wellness, Green Power and Wellness Show. I'm Harvey Wasserman. We're at 888-874-4888 if you want to call in, 888-874-4888. Margaret Flowers, how do you see the long-term growth of the Occupy Movement taking shape?
Yeah, I think Kevin's outlined some of it. What we really have is, you know, at the top of it, our vision where we want to go is we want to end corporate rule. We want to move to a society that's peaceful, just, and sustainable. Underneath that, how do we do that? There's kind of two phases. One is protesting and resisting the systems that are in place right now, but the other piece is building alternative systems that will ultimately replace them. And there's a lot that's been happening on that front, you know, for a while, and so we have a lot of experience to build upon, some momentum. So Kevin outlined some of the economic changes. You know, if we can democratize our economy, and there's strong movements now towards building more cooperatives, to instituting participatory budgeting, where people actually have local control over the capital expenditures from their councils, city councils, also moving towards public banking, credit unions, things like that, that really start to democratize the economy and put more economic control and benefit into the hands of the 99%. But the growing independent media is important. The number of free universities that are popping up all across the country, as well as, you know, movement towards sustainable food networks, to you know, more green sources of energy, you know, building towards a nuclear-free and carbon-free energy economy. All of these things will help to undermine that corporate power that's controlling our political process, and build the kind of society that we truly want to see.
Well, let's get down to one basic thing. I think the idea of the 1% versus the 99%. Has probably been one of the most effective political triumphs and sloganeering that is certainly in the last few decades. Can you, Margaret, give us kind of a definition of what the 1% is and what the 99% is?
Hey, well, what we're really talking about here is a wealth inequality in this country, and we're at the greatest disparity in wealth that we know of in the history of this country. It's worse than it was during the Depression. So we have really, it's the top, like, 0.1% that control most of the wealth in this country. If you look at the top 400 wealthiest people have the same wealth equivalent to the bottom 160 million. So 400 have the same wealth as 160 million. That's a huge, right? and if you look at, you know, us in terms of how we compare to other nations around the world, we're one of the top four nations in terms of the greatest wealth disparity. And if you start to look at what are called indicators of social well-being, so things like our health, our crime rates, violence, we're an outlier compared to all these other countries. We're just really off the chart in terms of not having good indicators of social well-being. And so that's really what the 99% is about, wealth inequality. We need to talk about the effects of wealth inequality on people, on our health, on our lives. And we've reached a real point in this nation where so many people are feeling this economic insecurity. It's like back in, you know, the 60s and 70s there, you know, with the Vietnam War, and when the draft was instituted, that was something that everybody felt. It galvanized the population. Well, right now, everybody's feeling this economic insecurity, and that's what's galvanizing us to, you know, come out of our homes to start talking about these issues and to work together.
And, you know, that wealth disparity,
go ahead, Kevin.
That wealth disparity that Margaret talks about is not because those 400 people work harder or are smarter. It's because the system is rigged. It's people not only feel the insecurity, which I think is a galvanizing fact for every family in the country, but they also see the unfairness. They see the crony capitalism. They see the corporate welfare. And, you know, they see the unfair taxes. I mean, right now it's tax time, so there's a lot of articles out. You can look all over the web and find stories about corporations not paying taxes. Those 400 people that Margaret mentioned who have the wealth of $160 million, they pay an average tax of 17.4%, while working Americans pay about 30%. So it's right there in your face. It's so unfair that 400 wealthiest people pay a tiny tax compared to wealth. Now, you know, President Obama, of course, is, you know, making hay with this, and, you know, the whole Buffett rule issue to play against his fellow 1%er. He's challenging Mitt Romney. But in fact, the Buffett rule is really totally inadequate. I mean, Buffett shouldn't be paying equal to his secretary. He should be paying a much higher progressive tax than his secretary. In fact, our progressive tax system has become very flattened. I don't know why we stop at the the 500,000 mark. Why isn't there a more progressive tax on people make a million and people make 5 million, 10 million? You know, we have the top 25 hedge funders. The lowest earner there was $400 million this year. I mean, what should a $400 million income pay in taxes? That person's probably paying about 15% because that's how hedge funders pay their taxes. But, you know, we need a much more progressive tax system. We need a Robin Hood tax that will tax speculation on Wall Street. We need a more aggressive estate tax, and we need a more aggressive corporate tax. If we just go back to the taxes of any decade, the late 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, even the early 80s, any of those decades, go back to those tax structures, we would have virtually no deficit. We've just warped the tax system so much with the intentional class warfare of the 1% against us, you know, ever since 1971, when the Powell memo, written by Lewis Powell, who became a Supreme Court justice. Before he became a justice, he wrote a memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce outlining essentially class warfare, how the 1%, how the corporate interests could take control of government, the media, schools, journals, just all aspects of change and shaping of policy in our country, and they've done that. And now we have to fight back, and the Occupy is a new stage in fighting back, and I think it's a hopeful sign, but we've got to do a lot of work to reach out in our communities and get people a sense that we have a real plan for moving power from the 1% to the 99%.
Let me just inject one thing as a historian here. We do know, we do have a sort of controlled experiment in that wealth discrepancy was really at a peak in the 1920s.
That's right.
And when the Depression happened and the New Deal came in, ironically, the wealth discrepancy started to diminish because
right.
of the social programs of the New Deal. And it diminished more or less steadily up until the Vietnam War. And with the coming of Richard Nixon and in the early 1970s, the wealth disparities began to grow again. And so we have seen in this country the wealth disparities really, really started to grow in the beginning, right after the Civil War, when the robber barons and the major corporations took over. So from the 1870s and 80s through the 1930s, wealth discrepancy really grew. Then it diminished through the 1970s, and now, of course, it's gotten totally out of control. And so what that really shows is that social programs do work, and we're working.
Social programs. I would say it also, in the New Deal, it was a different tax structure. We got to a 92% peak high tax in the mid-50s. It was above 70% up until Reagan, and so we've had a much higher progressive tax rate. We also had much stronger unions. I think there was a very important force.
Well, that's a big key, of course.
Big key. So I think it's a combination of those, the social safety net, a progressive tax system, and a countervailing force to stand against the concentrated corporate power. Those are the ingredients I think we need to
build. And it's important to point out, by the way, that it was a Democrat who really undercut the union movement, and that was Woodrow Wilson. Wilson, my least favorite president, by the way, along with Andrew Jackson, two Democrats. Wilson crushed the left labor movement using World War I as an excuse. That's actually why we got into World War I and arrested Eugene V. Debs and smashed the socialist movement in the period from 1918 to 1920.
I'd also say in the late 1940s, when the Democrat-dominated Senate overturned a veto by Harry Truman of the Taft-Hartley Act.
Correct.
The Taft-Hartley Act made it very hard for unions to organize, and that's when the steady decline of unions started. Really from 1955 on, the unions have been going downhill. Now they're a tiny percentage of the workforce. In fact, there are more employee owners of businesses than there are public members of public unions. So we're kind of the workforce power is changing. I think what we need to build into it is a new form of workforce power, and I do think that's going to be employee ownership more than unions. I think unions right now, because their leadership is so stale and so stuck in the trap of the Democratic Party. And that's the biggest risk for the Occupy movement, too, by the way, getting stuck in the Democratic Party. It's been a risk to every movement that's come before us. We need to make sure to avoid it. But the union leadership, particularly at the national level, is stuck in the Democratic Party, pouring hundreds of millions of dollars in every election into trying to elect Democrats, and they've been going downhill steadily since they've been tied to the Democratic Party.
We're on the Soapotopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I've got Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers from the Occupy Movement. We're at 888-874-4888 if you want to call in. 888-874-4888. Margaret, this is an interesting thing that Kevin raises about unions and worker ownership. What do you got to say about that?
Well, you know, actually this is the year, 2012 is the United Nations year of the cooperative, and the cooperative movement is growing there now. I think 120 or 130 million people in the United States that are members of some sort of cooperative. It could be a credit union or a local grocery store or a cooperatively owned business. And this is an important way that we can democratize the economy and build wealth locally. You know how, you know, Walmart comes into a community and they displace all of the local stores, and then that money goes to Arkansas, and the top, you know, the six Walmart heirs actually have the same wealth as 30% of the American public. So that's, you know, all that money is going to them and robbing our local communities. If we build employee-owned businesses, employee cooperative businesses in communities, that keeps that wealth right there at home, building that community up. An important example of this is something called the Evergreen Cooperative in Cleveland, Ohio, where they went into a community that had a very low, I think the average household income was $18,000. The individual average income was around $6,000 or $8,000. They started building cooperative businesses to serve local, what they call anchor institutions, the universities and the hospitals, institutions that don't go away, and they've brought, you know, more community wealth into that community, and they're growing. They take a portion of the money that's made from those cooperative businesses and invest them into new cooperative businesses. So this is an important model that we can look at. But I wanted to get back quickly to what you were saying about social programs and how after the Depression, you know, bringing in these important social programs, you know, assistance with housing, with education, worker, you know, jobs programs, these did have a tremendous effect. And what we're seeing right now is actually the complete opposite of that. Instead of bailing out people and forgiving student loans, which we should do, keeping people in their homes instead of evicting them and foreclosing on them, we're bailing out the big finance, we're bailing out the health insurance industry with this health bill, we're enforcing austerity measures. And imagine if instead of doing that, if we didn't bail them out, if we took that money and invested it in our community, one thing that I really favor is a taxpayer investment instead of corporate welfare. So instead of bailing out corporations or giving them money to do projects where then they keep the profits, imagine if we invested in a new green energy, carbon-free, nuclear-free economy, and then the profits that come from that would be distributed to us, to the people, much like they do in Alaska with the Alaska Permanent Trust, where part of the oil profits go to each person in Alaska. And I think the families, I think people get an average around $2,000 a year from that Alaska Permanent Trust.
Well, there you go. Who knew that Alaska would lead the way to socialism in America?
Yeah.
we're on with Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers of the Occupy Movement. We're going to take a break in a minute when you start to hear the music from my friend Dana Lyons, Cows with Guns. Fascinating conversation with two of the do you qualify as founders of the Occupy Movement?
I think organizers of Occupy Washington, D.C.
Oh, we like that. Okay, so Dana is coming on. When we come back, we'll talk a bit about an article by Danny Schechter, my lifelong buddy, about internal matters in Occupy, which always bore the hell out of me. I hate internal politics in the movement, but we'll deal with it briefly and continue. You guys are terrific guests, a lot of substance, and we'll be back in a moment. That's the wonderful Dana Lyons singing one of the Soapotopia songs. Dana of course, is known worldwide for the wonderful Cows with Guns anthem, the anthem of the vegetarian movement. I strongly urge you to look it up, cowswithguns.com, one of the great and funny animated cartoons of our day. We're on with Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flower of the Occupy movement. What a spectacular change this movement, which popped up pretty much out of nowhere, as far as I could see, and I thought I had my ear to the pulse. Is that a mixed metaphor, ear to the pulse of the public? Can you talk real quickly, Margaret and Kevin, about how Occupy popped up? Where did it come from?
Well, I can't tell you for everybody. I can tell you for us. In fact, we're about at the 1 year anniversary of us working in this field.
It's only a year.
We've been working in it for about a year. I mean, on Occupy. I've been an activist for a lot longer than that, and so has Margaret. But
yes, I want to say one thing before we lose track. I saw you two speak at the gathering in D.C. That was convened by Ralph Nader.
Right.
And, you know, there was the inevitable, and I think it's actually a healthy sign of dissension within the movement. And God forbid we should have a movement without dissension. And Kevin, I thought you, and Margaret, I thought you both did a great job of handling it. And Kevin, I think Margaret, too, you came out in the lobby later and talked to the young folks. And it was such a treat to have young people, you know, passionate about all this, and you talk with them, and it was really great. So I wanted to get that in there, but continue, please, with how it started internally.
For us, it started out of frustration. I mean, I work in a whole range of issues on economic justice and war and the drug war and peace issues. Margaret has been working on healthcare policy and then getting into other issues of economic justice and war as well. And we were working with other folks who were involved in a variety of issues, and we all felt the same frustration, and we sat down and talked about it. We wanted to do something that'd be effective. We were all very moved by what happened with in Tahrir Square in Egypt. We were moved, as Matt Margaret said earlier in the show, about what happened in Madison with the takeover of the Capitol and the occupation of the Capitol. And we also were seeing the beginning of the Spanish real democracy movement. And all those things kind of led us to saying, maybe we should try this here. And we started to discuss it and meet with other activists and say, what do you think? And everyone said, yes, it's time. I shouldn't say everybody, because there were some who thought that the pain threshold in the United States wasn't high enough yet, and others who said that we were being too radical. We, for example, contacted Van Jones. Margaret contacted Van Jones very early in the process, before Rebuild the Dream was ever mentioned, a couple months before that, and he thought we were too radical and that he wanted to work within the Democratic Party, so he wasn't comfortable with the direction we were going. But most people we talked to were very comfortable, had a very similar idea, and so we moved forward with that. We developed a large steering committee of about 40,
you're talking about 40 people?
Yeah, 40 people.
And this is in D.C.?
This is all over the country.
National.
Did you have conference calls?
We had our conference call, which I guess you now call a general assembly.
Uh-huh.
And we, you know, operate by consensus and discussion and try to come to figure out what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. And
God, you came to consensus on a conference call?
well, we had, you know, it was actually a great organizing structure, because we had various working groups, and the people on those working groups were people that were skilled in those particular areas, and then we, you know, they did our report back on a weekly conference call. I think we lived on conference calls for that 6 months, and we did some in-person meetings as well, where people traveled to various locations.
And we had people signing up to say they'll pledge to be on Freedom Plaza. People like Chris Hedges immediately signed up, Cornel West immediately signed up. About 150 organizations signed up to support it. And by
I think
the time,
Harvey, you were on that initial sign-up as well.
I think
well.
Harvey was one of them, yes. Harvey was, I think, an initial signer, too. And as we grew, we started to develop local coordinators. We had local coordinators in over 30 states. And then Occupy Wall Street was mentioned in July. So we announced, we started working in April. We went public in June, early June, and then in early July, Occupy Wall Street was announced in Adbusters, saying 20,000 people should occupy Wall Street, downtown New York.
Cool. And well, listen, I got to tell you, you know, as a geezer in this movement, we actually, in the Crenshaw Alliance, which began in New Hampshire in 1976, which occupied the Seabrook nuclear plant over a course of a couple of years, and which really gave birth in a lot of ways to the mass anti-nuclear movement, the No Nukes movement. Mm-hmm. One of our organizers, who's still a great friend of mine and now has an organization that fights the death penalty, Rennie Cushing, came up with the idea that we should send people down to Wall Street. There was a really strong, I wouldn't call it an occupation, I guess, but it was a really good demonstration on Wall Street in the mid-1970s, and Rennie is still alive and kicking and doing the same kind of stuff. So there's a great continuity here between what you guys, what the Occupy movement, and I guess I was a signer. Thank you for reminding me. And the anti-nuclear movement.
Yeah, not just that. You can go back to the March on Poverty that came out of the Martin Luther King's efforts.
Yes, that was spectacular.
Resurrection City. You can go back to the Bonus March back in the 1930s, 1932.
I will tell you, I was at the encampment in D.C. With Dr. King, or just after his assassination. But I am not old enough to have been with the Bonus Army. So.
And in 1906, there were farmers that occupied City Hall in Chicago because they were losing their farms. So occupation itself is not new. It's new to many of the young people that got involved, but it was something that was happening around the world, and it just felt like the energy was there for that. The time was right, and obviously the time was right because it really took off in the fall. People were just realizing that the traditional tools of democracy did not work in this country and that we needed to start doing things differently.
Freedom Plaza was almost, we had a lot of synergy with Occupy Wall Street right from the beginning, but, you know, we also had, as I said, like coordinators in the 32 states, and when Occupy started to take off, a lot of those coordinators decided to stay home and build Occupies at home. And so Freedom Plaza didn't get as big as it could have been, but the movement got bigger. And so we thought that was a great trade-off to have the movement become a national movement. Even if Freedom Plaza was a little bit smaller. So it was pretty impressive.
Well, it has really grabbed the imagination of activists and even people who aren't activists who are just having a hard time all over the world. It's been spectacular. I think one of the seminal or germinal sources has also been the almost pretty much spontaneous uprisings in the early 2000s, 15 million people, at least worldwide, who demonstrated against Bush's attack on Iraq.
No question.
Right. Right.
And that was a really big deal. We're on the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show with Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers of the Occupy movement. I want to mention there will be a major anti-nuclear conference in D.C. this weekend, sponsored by the Sierra Club. Are you guys going to go?
You know, I'm actually out of town this weekend.
Okay, well, it's going to be, we're setting policy, nobody's setting policy, they're discussing strategy for burying, finally, the nuclear power industry. I want to mention, by the way, that we are at a critical stage with nuclear power. The Occupy movement has become a good piece of the movement against nuclear power.
Right.
And the nuclear power industry, and I hope that the Occupy movement will take this on more aggressively, because the nuclear power industry is actually on the brink of death. And in my lifetime, I've been privileged to be able to be at the creation, in many ways, of the grassroots anti-nuclear reactor movement, which started more or less on a mass basis in the 1970s. And somehow or other, the phrase "no nukes" sort of found its way through my typewriter. And we began with Richard Nixon in 1974. And I say this in part to make it clear to people that we can have an impact. People who say, oh, the Occupy movement will just come and go. This doesn't happen that way. History does. The arc of history bends towards justice, you know. And when we first started in 1974, Richard Nixon said there'd be 1,000 nuclear plants in the United States by the year 2000, if you can imagine that. The year 2000 has come and gone, and there are 104. And we've seen a huge uprising, grassroots nonviolent uprising, especially in the state of Vermont now,
yes,
where we're really, really struggling, and I think on the brink of shutting the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant. And we also have a major confrontation going on over loan guarantees for two reactors proposed for the Vogtle site in Georgia, where these reactors are dependent on federal loan guarantees. And these loan guarantees are a complete ripoff.
You know, if there are no loan guarantees, there'd be no nuclear power. That's the, you know, without government backing, there's no nuclear power going forward.
Correct. And so we thought the, you know, it was Obama, of course,
yes,
who signed off on $8.33 billion for this reactor project, double reactor project in last spring. And most of us assumed that it was a done deal, but leaks came out, ironically, from the nuclear industry itself saying that this loan guarantee is not a done deal. And they're having trouble coming to terms because Southern Company, which owns Georgia Power, does not want to pay anything into the fund, doesn't want to put up any money for these loan guarantees. I mean, when you buy a house, you got to put up 20%. They don't want to put up zip. And apparently the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, which is part of the White House, is balking at that. Now, we had an instance last year where the electric utility of France, EDF, came in, and they wanted loan guarantees for the Calvert Cliffs project in Maryland. They couldn't get the terms with the OMB, and the project died. If we can, with Occupy's help, I hope, intervene and somehow put on the political pressure. There are at least three petitions circulating, one of which is a website I edit called www.nukefree.org. If we can get sufficient pressure on the Congress and on the White House to at least demand reasonable terms for this ridiculous loan guarantee, we think we can kill the Vogtle project, and that will be, I predict, the end of new nuclear plants in the United States. So I know you, Kevin and Margaret, have been focused a bit on this. Can you talk about how Occupy might interface with that?
Well, I think you should be more involved with Occupy on these issues. There's a weekly show on InterOccupy, a show, I guess it's more of a telephone call, an InterOccupy called Hot Topics. And we should introduce you to the guy who runs that so you can get on and talk about this.
Well, please do, and he can email me.
Yeah, how nuclear can get involved.
Or he or she.
Yeah, I think that'd be good for you to bring that in. I think Occupy needs to hear this. You know, the Occupy movement is definitely forward-looking. It recognizes, from what I can tell from talking to occupiers, and we've been all over the country, various encampments, and you know, it's looking toward a green energy economy for the future. I don't hear anyone advocating nuclear at the any Occupy encampment, and I think it's people also recognize that President Obama, you know, is kind of the best friend of nuclear in the White House, and if we can, and his Energy Secretary Chu is another good friend of nuclear, and we need to really let them know that that's not acceptable. And I think that in this election year, what's needed for the election year is for the Occupy to show the distance between what the people want and what the government is doing. Because on issue after issue, including the one you're talking about now, Harvey, on issue after issue, the people want one thing and the government's going the opposite direction. And that's the dysfunction and the disconnect that we need to highlight in this election year.
Well, you want to say a bit about President Obama and how Occupy... Well, I guess you can't really speak for Occupy as a unified...
No one can.
No. I was just in here realizing that the very first mass protest I went to was the no-nuclear protest in the 1970s in Washington,
D.C. Where were you?
And I still have... I grew up in Northern Virginia. I still have my T-shirt from that. It has a big sun on it, and says, I think, no nukes on it. So,
unlike me, her T-shirts from the 70s still fit.
But I think, you know, that there are definitely avenues within Occupy for educating more occupiers about what's going on. InterOccupy, the Hot Topics is a great call to get on, but in addition to that, InterOccupy is a tool for organizing protests. So I would urge you to get involved or contact some of the occupations in Georgia and perhaps plan some sort of an action that can be done to raise public awareness and galvanize people. Because once the corporations or those who are elected officials realize that people are aware and are out on the streets, it really does cause them to lose some of their bravado and you know, stop acting so blatantly as we see happening. I mean, it's amazing that this nuclear industry is demanding, you know, that they pay nothing. But that's how blatant the corporate, you know, concentration
is. You can be sure, Harvey, that Obama does not want to be tied to the nuclear issue in this election year. I mean, Fukushima and all the other problems we've seen around in the United States as well as around the world, you know, it's not something you want to be tied to. So if you have protests, if you guys can organize a protest in Georgia at these plants to highlight this economic mess that they're creating with these loan guarantees, it is not something he's going to want to proceed forward on. And so they'll cut and avoid that mess.
Well, the same Randy Cushing from the Clamshell Alliance that helped organize the first Occupy Wall Street stuff in the 1970s also just went down with 700 people and got arrested at the headquarters of Entergy, the corporate owner of the Indian Point, Vermont Yankee, and many other nuclear power plants. And so, but you're right about this. I'm putting out a piece tonight called Obama's Atomic Solyndra.
Great.
Listing. Do we have a caller, Matt? Okay, just hold her for a sec. Oh, put her in, please. Sandy, we're joined by Sandy, editor of the Solar Times. Sandy, say hi to Kevin and Margaret, please.
Hello, Kevin. Hey, Margaret.
Hey, how you doing?
Sandy edits a wonderful magazine called the Solar Times and has her own show on PRN. Sandy, what do you got for us?
Well, you know, Harvey, you've been pleading with me to call in, so here I am, and I saw your post on Facebook, and I thought, you know, I was hoping maybe if you have time in the next few minutes that you could talk a little bit more about what's coming to be known as energy democracy or local ownership of renewable power as sort of a critical piece of challenging corporate power. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, Kevin Zeese and Dr. Flowers, is the Occupy movement tackling this issue at all, for one thing? And if I could stay on the line, because I had
some... Oh, yeah, stay with us.
Well, yeah, the Occupy movement has been very supportive in Washington, D.C. whenever there's been the climate change tar sands protests going on. We've been very much going to those and making the Occupy presence known. So there's no question Occupy recognizes the climate change issue. And, of course, we all, you know, the critical issue we're all facing is corporate power and concentration of energy in the coal, nuclear, and oil industries, carbon industries, is the issue. And I think we really need to spread the idea out there about how you can have every home become an energy producer, and that's where the future is that kind of dispersed energy production. And so I think that's a great issue to really highlight to occupiers. I think most of them already get it, you know, but I think more information on that is essential. And, you know, the German model, you know, where people essentially get paid to cover their roofs with solar, and every space they have with solar to make income, is one we should be talking about very, very aggressively in the United States.
Yeah, I want to note, by the way, I just posted an article at nukefree.org that the city of Toronto has now made it legally binding to put green roofs on all new buildings in Toronto.
Wow.
It's an amazing step. Toronto's a big city. That's an amazing step forward.
Wow.
The Solartopian vision is a vision of a renewable energy economy built totally on renewables and controlled by the public. One thing I would have to say for Obama, I'm certainly not a fan, is that he has been pretty aggressive in pushing renewables. And so while they've been supporting nukes with this loan guarantee, by the way, this is the first year since the early 2000s that there has been no new money proposed for nuclear loan guarantees. And this is, I don't attribute this to the Obama administration. It's because of the Occupy and you know, the grassroots opposition.
What's so critical for people to understand is that it's not as important as who's in the White House as what we're doing outside the White House and how organized we are and how vocal we are and how mobilized we are. That's the most important thing. I mean, these presidents and elected officials often have to go against their own wishes, their own funders' wishes, if the people are organized. And that's what we got to do. That's our job, is to build an independent movement that can transform this country.
Margaret?
Harvey, Dr. Flowers, and Kevin, may I just say one more thing before I jump off here?
Please.
I just wanted to say that a few weeks back I was talking with author, also historian, and political economist Gar Alperovitz, who you may know of, in fact, right here on PRN. And just for our listeners who might not know, he's just an eloquent advocate for what he calls the democratization of wealth. And he sort of focuses on, you know, this is what he focuses on, and sort of the mobilization of communities, especially at the local level, and as you were saying, Kevin, the decentralization of power, and essentially democratic planning in support of community and sort of long-term ecological and economic goals, I guess what you would call sort of socially friendly or equitable forms of capital ownership. So, you know, I asked him about energy democracy actually in an email, And he argues that, you know, this is really key to the sort of broader democratization of wealth in this country. And I there's no time to go in here to how this became a key issue for me and for Solar Times, maybe another time. But I just wanted to kind of drop that into the conversation, because right now with the community choice aggregation craze that's going on, it's a very important movement, but it's being rapidly taken over by big oil. And a lot of people aren't aware of this. It's happening here in Marin County with Shell Oil. And
right.
I just wanted to sort of drop that into the conversation. I think it's going to be a critical part of, you know, maybe what the Occupy movement might want to, it might be a way for me to plug in fact.
Right. Well, let me say, you know, inevitably, invariably, two things always happen when movements get powerful. Corporations try to co-opt them, and there are internal disputes. Thankfully, we didn't have time today to talk about the internal disputes in Occupy, and I have no interest in it. So, Margaret, what is the next big thing? You know, Sandy Lee of Easton, thank you for joining us, Sandy. You're welcome to stay on. Your Solar Times is excellent. We really appreciate it. I want to mention that I will be putting out a piece tonight about Obama's atomic Solyndra, which I hope the Occupy press will, the alternative media, which you mentioned, the people's media, thank God for the Internet, will help spread. But Dr. Margaret Flowers, what's going to happen next with Occupy?
Yeah, well, as we said earlier, the biggest push right now is to build the movement and to educate ourselves. We've just come off of 2 weeks of a social forum that was held in D.C. as part of the National
Occupation. Oh, yeah, that was fantastic. I wasn't able to get to it, but it really looked terrific.
Well, we were able to video many of the workshops, so we'll be getting those posted on the nowdc.org website and getting that information out there. I think the next question. NATO and the G8, we're organizing an Occupy G8 People's Summit to bring forth the policies that would actually, you know, protect the planet, stop the exploitation of people, and bring us greater wealth equality. People are organizing to be in Chicago for the NATO. There's work towards building a national gathering in July in Philadelphia. And much of the work is being done locally. Many people now are engaged in their local working groups and working on these different issues like energy, like food production, like building free universities. I love that Sandy mentioned Gar Alperovitz. We're a big fan. He just released a new edition of America Beyond Capitalism, where in addition to encouraging people to organize, you know, get involved at the local level, he also recommends dividing kind of into regional governance and looking at bioregions, so that if we're making policy on a bioregional basis, then we're all interested in protecting that part of the planet that we depend upon. As you know, in Maryland, the Chesapeake watershed extends over Pennsylvania, Virginia, Maryland, D.C. If we all were concerned about that, then Pennsylvania wouldn't be dumping things into the water that affect people downstream. We'd all be trying to protect that waterway. So that's an interesting idea as well.
Fantastic. Kevin Zeis, we're on with Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeis of the Occupy Movement. We're running out of time. I could talk to you. In fact, I will talk with you guys for another show. If you can come back in 2 weeks, that would be wonderful. Next week on the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, we're going to have Dr. Alan Goldhammer talking about fasting and natural health and diet, which really fits into the whole thing, as you'll hear next week. Kevin, on our way out, tell us what's next.
Well, people should just get involved. There's so many opportunities to, you know, we try to keep things up to date on our D.C.
website. Give us your website information, please.
I'll give you two websites, OccupyWashingtonDC.org. We try to keep up to date on lots of Occupy activities. And then our economic website is itsoureconomy.us. Itsoureconomy.us, and it's all about democratizing the economy, much like what Gar Alperovitz has been talking about for years. So that's what we see as the agenda ahead, is really bringing real democracy to the economy and real participatory democracy to the government. And this is really, I think, coming down to be more and more clearly a democracy movement where people can get power and take it away from those who control the government and the economy right now.
All too short. We'll run to an end here as Pete Seeger to sing the Soarutopia song. Thank you so much, Margaret Flowers, Dr. Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeese of the Occupy Movement. Come back and see me in 2 weeks if you would, if we can. And keep up the great work at the Occupy Movement. I'll see you at www.newtree.org, and we'll see you in Soarutopia, a green-powered, socially just, and peaceful planet.
Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know?